Hey everybody, this is Yusuf Khatib, CEO and co-founder of Global Skills Hub. Welcome to another episode of Diversion and Exclusivity, Yusuf's Adventures in Zebra Hunting. Today, we're going to learn about ASCO 19. On March 15th, when my little sister, Aisha, who some of you may have seen the video by now, sent me a Medium article about this open source, not-for-profit that was launching out of Vancouver, started by two brothers, Dr. Ray and Dr. Roger Ng, who were doctors who knew how to code. I'm incredibly privileged to tell you all about this story today by asking them a bunch of questions on how we met and how we took over 300 developers in kind, artificial intelligence, machine learning engineers, marketing, PR, some of the brightest minds across the world, and were able to in kind produce an app that could answer the question, can we spread information faster than this virus?
Boys, healthcare and new tech, you guys are the future.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What do you want to be when you grow up?
A technical doctor.
Wow, I'm really impressed.
And Armand, what do you want to be when you grow up?
A technical policeman.
Oh, that's amazing too.
Yeah, so they wanted to listen in on this interview a bit because they want to learn how to be technical and a doctor and technical and a policeman and other things in life because you guys are both.
Yeah.
But we wanted to just ask you a few questions. It's an exciting week for you as this vision of yours has finally launched and, I know that it's as much as it's launched, there's a whole bunch more that's coming down the pipeline. So, I think what was important is to really have everyone out there understand what was the vision behind this and how this all started and who is Dr. Ray and Dr. Roger and how did we all come to meet and so on. So I really just wanted to, we started this podcast a little while ago, and it was really focused on the impact economy, and I had just learned about the United Nations SDGs. We were talking a lot about the zebra movement, and inside of all of that, we've connected all and put together this this wonderful piece of hope, I think, in a time of despair. So I guess to begin with, like, why don't we be in here who's the older brother?
I'm the older brother.
Dr. Roger, yeah. Okay. So maybe Dr. Leonard,
I may have coerced Raymond to go in medicine.
But, of course, yeah. So how did that all start? How are you guys doctors? What kind of doctors are you, and who are you?
Yeah. So I'm a cardiologist. I deal with all things related to things like heart attack and even people that were born with congenital heart conditions that have been doing incredibly well now that live into their older ages and in almost normal lives. We take care of them as well. So we deal with a very specialized group of patients, and we go really deep in the clinical treatment of cardiac patients. And I am the older brother, so I had an opportunity to kind of walk this path a little bit before Ray. But in general, both Ray and I come with a lot of common grounds. So he I'm going to let him talk about his field of medicine himself. But in general, both of us cover a very wide expanse of clinical practice. So he deals with primary care, pretty much all comers. And I deal with the people that after he diagnosed them with heart conditions, they actually come over to us.
We'll cut that out of the window. One second.
Yeah, so we've worked together on multiple projects in our lifetime, and we work really well together. One of the things that we have noticed in the more recent couple of years that we've been working together is we've realized is that a lot of the technologies that we've been using are beginning to shape everything around us, except for the home court, right? Medicine has not yet adopted some of the latest technologies that we're using very aggressively. Things like communication tools, things like the ability to use web technologies to access patients, And so what we've been very excited about recently and been working very diligently on before the COVID-19 pandemic was to be able to bring some of the advanced technologies in both Raymond's area of specialties and my areas of specialties into the clinical practice space. And so that's kind of where we began.
Yeah.
And, okay, awesome. Dr. Ray, I want to hear a little bit about you, and then we'll talk a little bit about exactly where we're at right now. But yeah, a little bit of your background and in terms of how did Dr. Roger actually coerce you into medicine would be great to understand as well.
Yeah. No, I would reframe that a little bit. I would actually say more in lines with Inspire. My brother, he's 6 years my senior, and just being able to watch through and live through his successes and his pitfalls and his struggles, trials and tribulations, I do believe that success leaves breadcrumbs. And following through in what works and what doesn't, I kind of found myself in a position and training which we would call full scope family medicine. So for those that don't know what that means, what might connect a little bit more with folks, and I say this with the most respect, is cradle to grave medicine, which means from delivery of babies and prenatal care through the 9 months, all the way through adolescence, middle age, through to geriatrics. And so in healthcare systems like Canada, we're often referred to as the gatekeepers. And that is what you could say, a full breadth of medical conditions. Mostly prevention is our focus. And when things get to very granular medical conditions, we do have the resources, such as my brother, which is a cardiologist, who is able to spend a little bit more time with folks as our patient panels. Typically run in the thousands plus, 1,000, maybe 1,500 patients. And so we also do deal with heart failure, diabetes, cardiomyopathies, but also, pediatric care, prenatal care as well.
That's interesting. The last guest that we had on here was Zainab Muse, and she was studying to be a pediatric neurosurgeon, or she was in pre-med and ended up launching a business instead and didn't go. As we kind of transitioned, tell me a little bit more about, where did you guys grow up?
Yeah, for sure. So it's a very small, what you could call a village, actually. It's a small town in British Columbia in an area called the Okanagan Valley. So if you can imagine, we'd be likened to free-range children. free-range children. Open nature, wide landscapes, farmland, orchards, and the ability to explore what we're passionate about. And so that led us down the rabbit trail a little bit differently. In the early days, Roger really went down the rabbit trail of learning to code. He had his first Tandy computer and was programming in BASIC. Back in those days, I do recall just looking over his shoulder and passing as he's staring at a DOS screen, writing lines of, in terminal, writing lines of code there. I spent a lot of times outdoors as well, and having a very wide interest in many topics is very fitting for a family physician, actually.
In terms of growing, obviously, I come from an Indian background, and there's two doctors in our family. It's there's very few choices that you're given growing up to be a doctor. Was there a lot of influence growing up where you were you wanted to code and then you became a doctor, or was it something that you wanted both of that? How did that all kind of come together?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That free range autonomy that Ray was talking about was, I think, quintessential in the inspiration of the coding process. Very early on, we get to experiment with lots of different things. Some of that inspiration was fostered a lot by our grandparents as well. Our grandparents are, they, even though they came from the background in Hong Kong and Asia, they were very keen on our education. And so they drove us in the pathway of literacy. They drove us in the pathway of even sciences, actually. I remember, you know, even though my grandma was, you know, in her 60s to 70s, what inspired a lot of that was her teaching us how electricity worked, you know, with wires, cables, light bulbs. And then we just kind of advanced on that. And then, you know, by yourself, by trial and error, we sort of realized that we're a very sort of drawn to the electronics, science textbooks, science fictions, and so forth. And that's kind of where a lot of the stuff began. You know, we really wanted to kind of design our own robots, wanted to make our own talking bots. And so that first Tandy that Ray was talking about, that was my first task. And we ended up getting that from the community as well. We didn't have the resources to buy a brand new computer at the time. And so we went to our neighbors that had been doing industrial level press and the local newspaper, right, with the Tandy computer that they had. But they were upgrading and say that they no longer needed the computer there. And that community really fostered our the ability to kind of advance in terms of our education. They gave us that computer by donation. And we took that. It was amazing. And we started hacking with that. And lo and behold, I think that was where my first code project actually worked. And when the first code project worked, that basically seeds that momentum, that positive feedback that you need to continue going on from there. And what we built there was literally a talking bot from the terminal where you're able to ask a question and it gave you an answer.
Okay. And this is like, what year are we talking here?
Well, this is quite a while ago. I mean, I don't want to date myself, but
Roger, I'm thinking you and me are pretty much around the same age, right?
Yeah, I know. Exactly. So, I won't give it up if you won't give it up.
Right? Listen, I'm a proud man. I was born on February 29th. I just celebrated my 10th birthday. So I give up my, you know, I give up my birthday all the time.
There you go.
Yeah, it turns out that we do too. So yeah, this was probably when I was, you know, about 9 or 10 years old.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I'm not as young as some of the other coders were, but we didn't have the luxury of being in Silicon Valley. I think that was really the difference. I mean, so if you imagine in Silicon Valley, where I've now learned all the stories, right, where they had fathers that were their neighbors that were working in places like, you know, IBM and just like incredible manufacturing companies, and all the technology was there. That's essentially what built a lot of the foundations that have occurred in Silicon Valley. But it can also occur in small villages like ours, where, you know, we had local engineers, we had people that that were local repairmen, and they all gave us the technology to build machines, right? We built our own motorcycles. We built our own trucks with the computers that you're talking about, the coding, the library that all existed there. And so, yeah. So,
you know, I want to interrupt you there for a second, because I think there's two very important things that we need to touch on right now. And I would be remiss if we missed them out. And I think you said something incredibly important. You know, today we're here to talk about the not-for-profit open source project that you guys launched, ASCO 19. And as we're talking a little bit and getting a little bit more to this opportunity to get to know you better, you started your, you know, essential coding career by the kindness of others, you know, where essentially someone donated this computer to you. And I think it's incredibly powerful. And I hope you take that opportunity to just breathe that in for a second, that the circle of reciprocity that's been created is now you guys have created a not-for-profit that is trying to save the world.
Yeah, you know what, Yusuf, I can't stress this enough. And, you know, I will segue off what Roger said there, is that we are a product of the goodwill and the selflessness of our communities. And when you look at the open source community, you know, it might appear as if it moves slowly compared to some of the other development communities. But what you see is it's quite fundamental, and it's intentional in the way that it's built. And the nature and the personalities of these open source projects reflect that givingness that you had just discussed there. So it's you know, it's been a very great experience and good fortune to experience that.
You know, we had Adina on our team here at Global Skills Hub. What she's been doing is she's been interviewing a bunch of people throughout the Slack. You know, in particular, she was looking at some of the Global Skills Hub community members. You know, I want to read something to you. And it says, just to kind of put a little credibility into kind of what you're saying exactly there, is that, you know, this gentleman on our Slack named Tunji, and, you know, he's a volunteer software developer. He's out of Nigeria. And he goes, we just asked him, why did you decide to get involved with ASCO 19? And his response was, things are difficult in the world right now. Most people feel powerless. They wish they could do something. And he goes, I am glad just to be able to do something, however small. Right. And you know, I think that echoes what you're really talking about in that open source kind of, you know, community from there. There's another gentleman, Nathaniel, who, you know, was responsible for making sure that UNIDO kind of came on board and did a sponsorship and partnership with us. And, you know, what he, you know, some of the stuff that he said was just mind blowing in terms of, you know, how lucky he feels to actually be a part of being able to help. And he's like, you know, I'm a family man, you know, I'm a family person. And, you know, this is my way of, you know, kind of showing and doing my part for my family and then the rest of the families across the world. And, you know, I know family is a big theme here as well that we've kind of been talking about. And so I want to kind of segue into how we met. And let's talk a little bit about that quickly. So, you know, I'm the CEO and co-founder of Global Skills Hub. You know, we supply senior tech talent to the Canadian tech ecosystem. And I'm fortunate and blessed to know some of the world's best developers. And so my sister, Aisha, Dr. Aisha Khabib, she's done a fellowship in infectious diseases. You know, she's a clinical director of a travel health clinic. And she's really been on the front lines of COVID-19 in terms of testing assessment centers and so on. And, you know, what I really wanted to do is I was worried about her. And, you know, I'm an older brother, just like you are, Roger. And, you know, that's just something that happens as older brothers. You know, we have that means that it doesn't matter if they're 8 years old or if they're 35 years old. You know, we're still going to worry about them and we're still going to want to take care of them. And so I had enlisted my community to go out there and do market research with Aisha in order to build her an app. And 48 hours later, she forwards me a Medium article where, you know, we talk about where, you know, the Medium article that you guys had published. And she just said, she goes, Pigeon, I think these guys are doing what you want to do for me. And so I immediately sent you guys an email. And on March 17th, just a short while ago, you know, we had that first meeting for where we met. So, you know, in that meeting, you guys gave me the vision of ASCO 19 or what is, you know, at that time was Entithinian and became a not-for-profit ASCO 19. And so I'd love for you to share what was the vision that you shared with me here with everyone that's listening today.
Yeah, that's amazing, Yusuf. So I completely understand what you were talking about. And I think in this particular case was exactly how I felt, right? We had seen what was happening in China. This was actually seen by my wife, who had been very tied to the communities in Asia. And so very early on, and actually potentially a little bit ahead of the curve, we actually already felt that it was actually going to be coming into our community. And one of the things that I did early on was I actually reviewed the articles directly, the publications of the epidemiology from New England Journal of Medicine published in China as of early March. It was incredible the time of publications that they were able to do. They were able to spin a couple of publication out literally within weeks. So a lot of the data that they were able to publish was you know, fresh off the press. And I saw a difference in the way the media was trying to deliver the message, which was a good message. And they were trying to get their point across. They were trying to tell people that it was coming. But I got to say, a lot of us, you know, even within my own household, between my wife and I, we've had a 180 degrees difference in terms of how seriously we took that problem. It was only after weeks of being told that, you know, this thing is looking really bad. And my wife is actually a cardiologist, that I finally said, let me look at these articles and take a look. And within 2 seconds of reading the abstract and looking at the results, I felt it, because the publications that were published from China made a very distinct comparison between SARS and SARS-CoV-2, which is the current COVID-19 disease. And what it looked like was the virus nature has the same cycle, has the same infectivity, but the only difference there was that it was killing people at an order of magnitude of 400 times higher in a shorter period of time. And in fact, we didn't know at that particular time and point that the R-naught might have been slightly a little bit underreported from China, you know, not because they didn't know, but it was because the data was only coming in so rapidly, right? So that sent a sense of urgency and, you know, potentially emergency through pretty much every bone in my body. And then I looked at my brother and I looked at my family and I looked at our entire community, not to mention our patients, which are all comorbid patients so that have cardiac disease. And we needed to do something, right? And so the idea was, can we bring the experience and the knowledge that I just saw from a publication from frontline providers that were dealing with the virus in real time to people that you can clearly see saw it, but were at different stages of the understanding and not to mention the acceptance of this thing that was coming? And so the whole platform and concept was, can we create a platform that can ask questions from here in the United States or from Canada, where my brother was, to places like China, Italy, all of Southeast Asia and Asia, and bring that experience that they were experiencing because they were physicians too and people that want to share that same experience with the world. As we learn later on, they were actually very, very giving and generous in terms of what they were giving to the rest of the world. Right down to the troops that were getting ready and how should we get ready for the coming surge. And that was the...
I want to pause you on that, because that you bring up an interesting point there. And I want to ask you this question, because I'm starting to feel this and I wonder if you guys are as well, is that there was a time where we were really hungry for real-time information because, you know, everyone, you know, this thing was coming at us. And, you know, we're a bit different because we're getting access to data in real time right now. So, we get to see what's happening in a really interesting way. But when we talk about the general public, have you seen a change in that people have almost accepted that it's here and it's going? Or do you feel that it has the same type of urgency that you and I are dealing with on a daily basis that we were dealing with 5 weeks ago?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. Ray, did you want to take on that one?
Yeah, you know, like... One of the things to consider is the stage that we're at right now, right? You know, if you were to look at the five stages of loss from Kubler-Ross, and, you know, starts at denial and then anger and then bargaining, depression, and acceptance, and everyone sort of enters this at different stages, difficult to predict where, and they kind of make their way through those stages. And so if you were to ask, you know, from a, you know, broadly speaking, where are we at? You know, you probably... hit that, you know, dead on, is that we're at this sort of acceptance stage, perhaps. And this is very important to double down on, is that you, as you start to hear discussions of what is a reopening plan, right? Reopening the country, reopening the provinces and the states, depending on where you're at, you know, what are the things to really focus on? And this is a very important conversation. You know, if you look at the healthcare systems now, it's important for us to really pursue something called contact tracing. So as many places you might see the curve flattening, it's more important than ever now to really be able to identify these high-risk individuals, long-term care facilities, folks that are symptomatic, and be able to really track those in a sense that we can be diligent moving forward. You know, there was a lot of lessons learned, and it's important that all of the sacrifices that were made up until now, all of the lessons that were learned up until now, were not at a loss, you know? So moving forward, that need to self-isolate and really retrench, right? That need to self-quarantine if you're symptomatic, to stay 2 meters apart. There really is no other option at this particular point, because we can't really let things get out of hand after sacrificing so much.
Yeah, and I think, I'm not sure if you guys read the Gates note that came out about Pandemic One. I believe it was just yesterday. I actually posted it on LinkedIn and said that, you know, I read two incredibly powerful pieces this week. One was Mark Andreessen's, essay or letter that he, you know, published. And the other one was this one by Bill Gates. And he talked about a lot of this stuff in terms of contact tracing, in terms of opening up and the vaccines and what it actually takes to get a vaccine put together. But, you know, at the end of the day, it all comes back to information.
And, you know, what I feel right now is that, you know, we're in information overload. And, you know, and so when we're in information overload, what I do whenever I have a medical issue that I need answered is I pick up the phone and I call my sister. You know, we had a situation with my mother about 24 hours ago. She had to go to emergency, and immediately, you know, like my sister's on the phone, she's talking to the doctor, and then afterwards she's updating us. And the beauty of her updating us is she updates us in English and doesn't update us in doctorese. You know, we got to pull her back because she starts flying, and then she says all the stuff that I don't understand. And, you know, I think I've gotten a medical degree just talking to her sometimes. But, you know, coming back to information, why is this platform so important to spread real information? You know, not the opinions of the, you know, different media and you know, people that are out there spreading their stuff, or maybe even world leaders, but you guys are spreading information. Why is this so important?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the people have to maintain vigilance, you know, during this time. I think a couple of things that we learned from the front lines pertaining to information is that, you know, particular physicians that have to deal with life and saving information and decision making and informing people of what it means for pieces of information, we can kind of speak to that pretty clearly. So first of all, what we realize is that most physicians rely on other physicians to be able to make complex decisions. So what that means is that there are certain people that are just experts at particular topics, particular specializations, particular diseases, particular problems. And so when you have a problem, just know that you're not alone, right? You have experts in the room that can potentially help you with that. And actually, it turns out that the more people that you talked about, particularly people that have expertise, I mean, it may not be the best of the best at that one particular question. But as long as they're actually working and practicing in that field, you can utilize that resource combined with other people in that area or loosely in that area. And it turns out that when you get consensus like that, you actually get a good decision out of it. And so the information travel to you should be sort of vetted in a situation where you have experts in the room or practicing experience in the room that can actually take that information and give you good practical decisions. And so one of the things that we've done very early on is that we've kind of parsed the community that can answer these questions to individuals that are verified physicians. So these verified physicians are usually general practitioners or experts, specialists, infectious disease people in the room. And what they do is they can choose the type of information that they want to answer to. So if they're more comfortable answering in cardiac world like I am, then I answer, you know, the questions that were pertaining to cardiac symptoms, cardiac injury from COVID-19 or other things, and be able to provide an answer with pretty good confidence from my standpoint. And then my colleagues behind me who see my answer and also see the information that I've wrote inside the platform can actually add to that or change that if they need to or rate it in a particular way. And so therefore, the information is in that regards somewhat vetted and somewhat done by expert opinions and potentially be able to provide information at a better level.
So, you know, like, let's give an example of that. One of the examples that we used when we were, when you were explaining this to me, was this whole challenge and stuff that came up with ibuprofen. You know, in the beginning, people were saying it was bad, then later on it was okay and stuff like that. Let's use that as an example when you explained it to me. So, you know, how that information would have changed in time on the platform.
Yes.
Yeah, that's an excellent question.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I would say is that in these unprecedented times, the pace at which the information changes is very dramatic, you know, rolling by every 24 hours, right? Or every few days or weekly, the information's changing and updating as the research rolls out. And so what you'll find is a discrepancy amongst opinions among specialists. And so when you kind of drill down to frontline physicians that are working on this and are actually seeing specific cases, what you end up is in a situation where you have to practice faster than the pace that the research is coming out. And so then the question comes, you know, how can you evolve your practice at a rapid pace. And that's one of the reasons in which this project actually came out, ASCO 19, is it started off as an open source hackathon called Code versus COVID, because, you know, in reality, we couldn't move as fast as the virus was spreading. And so the information needed to travel at the speed of code. And so as that information changes, how do you actually disseminate that and broadcast that to the public in a credible way? And that's sort of where this came out, right? And if you see, what's important is not one individual's decisions or opinions in this case, but more of a crowdsourced opinion, right? Because what you come to realize is that it's actually the accumulation of many frontline providers that gives you a bird's eye view of what's happening and what works and what doesn't.
And how I see this, let me talk a little bit about this, Yusuf, a little bit too. This is actually a really good example to play out, because this is something that ibuprofen has been something that has been in the discussions between here, China, between us and China, and literally in clinical practice within the last couple of weeks. So I can speak pretty confidently with how the decision process with ibuprofen comes about. So you have a virus that has absolutely no treatment for, and then not to mention no data for, right at the very beginning. So at the very beginning of the pandemic, we barely kind of knew how this was traveling, how it was transmitting, let alone the pathophysiology. The only thing that we knew about the virus was it was a coronavirus. Very quickly, after the coming days, we realized that it behaved very differently from other coronaviruses in terms of how it entered the cells, how it bound, why it was infecting individuals. And so with having to actually get information on that really required basic level sciences, combine that to all the way to tying that into clinical outcomes, which is not going to occur within weeks, right? These are typically journals that take months, if not years, to publish. And so what you can rely on at that point is not from data. What you have at that point is limited to understanding of prior knowledge, prior pathophysiology. And the best individuals to be able to talk about pathophysiology are physicians that have been dealing with unknown entities like that all their lives in a field that is filled with unknowns, based on what they understand from pathophysiology. And so that's why the ibuprofen question is a really nice highlight to why physicians are important in this fight for COVID-19. First, because it's a disease, and that's what physicians deal with all day long. That's their bread and butter. But the second thing, it turns out that evidence-based medicine, as our mentors from Hopkins have told us, is not the end-all be-all, right? These are guidelines. And then so it only explains a small portion of all of clinical practice. What physicians are really good at doing is projecting and predicting and basically integrating what they know from their medical school training, from their clinical training, from their specialty training into a decision plan and a plan for their patients to best optimize the outcome in territories where evidence-based medicine is still sparsely or loosely tying in. And so when you have a situation where you have a complete unknown virus, the best way to tackle this thing is using physician knowledge and the knowledge of their pathophysiology combined with years and years of clinical practice, not to mention clinical training, to try to figure out what the best path is for something like, can I use ibuprofen? Because they understand, first of all, how ibuprofen works, right? It goes through the inflammatory cascade and what it's caused in the past, right? Ibuprofen causes heart attacks in the past in patients that have heart disease, right? Particularly for a virus that causes thrombosis in the coronary arteries. So if you combine those two levels of knowledge, what you realize is that you see a trend. You see a trend that ibuprofen can cause increased clotting. And you see a trend where a virus can actually injure the endothelial cells and cause heart attacks in and of itself. And so it becomes somewhat, it leads you closer to the answer of why ibuprofen, or at least gives you a signal that ibuprofen might be a red flag in a particular situation like that. And so then comes the clinical practice and so forth like that to kind of fill that data in. So as we know over time, obviously, China has been using ibuprofen in certain patients, but all of us are still very, very careful not to push too much NSAIDs in patients with COVID-19. Now, there are clinical data, and then there's also understanding the clinical data as well. So we realize that unless you have a big enough representative trial, a lot of these data, whether it plays out in your patients or whether it plays out in patients with different types of demographic profiles, that's still to be seen. And so while we wait for that data to come out, the best thing is to look for the clinical judgment of individuals that have dealt with this kind of thing before.
Right. And so, you know, with I guess I want to maybe put it this way. Was this built in your mind more for physicians, or was this built more for the public?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. In the very beginning, when we began to build the tool had two sides to face to it. And so what we had hoped to achieve prior to working on COVID-19 was an AI physician platform that can actually help patients answer their questions. Obviously, it would require some physician input as oversight or supervision. But eventually, what it would be able to do is if a patient asked a question and the question was not answered directly in the database, that it would either make some sort of prediction on what the answer should be, or have a physician answer the question in the background and capture new knowledge. Now, that became different when COVID-19 occurred, which pretty much was literally in the time span of days. We realized that a tool like this may be very important to actually capture something in real time, right? So where a lot of the medical industry and the healthcare system has been doing large randomized double-blinded control trials, those things take usually a lot of time to complete, not to mention years in preparation, right? What we're really not good at and what we really need to work at is learning in real time. You know, every physician can learn in real time. And now we have systems that can learn in real time. We just haven't implemented it yet. But what we know is that if we could implement something fast enough in real time and capture potentially a way or a path forward in a pandemic, this would be absolutely vital in future pandemics.
Right. So I want to shift a little bit just to be respectful of time. I actually know you guys, do have to go to work as well. While you've been building all of this, you've still been, serving all of us and all of humanity here as you go ahead in your regular jobs as doctors. But I want to shift a little bit and talk a little bit about the project in terms of how all these people came together, this open source and so on. But one thing, you know, I'm a big believer in decentralization. Kind of living in a borderless world, which is interesting because I run a global migration business, and now we've been thrust into a remote, in a remote world. And so talk to me a little bit about, where you see the necessity of decentralization and being borderless.
I'm glad you touched base on that, Yusuf, because this is something that has touched me for many years now. The way that medicine practices in this day and age right now is quite fragile. It's very siloed. So, what we know is medical records and medical data does belong to the patient, and they should have quick and easy access to it. In a world now, prior to the pandemic, where it was very global, the ability to actually move your medical data around was very, very difficult. And so what ends up happening is healthcare costs can balloon for various reasons. And so that the way that I had described, decentralization as it pertains to us was sovereign data, right? So a patient can own their own data, they can control its movement, they retain the value behind it, but also sovereign identity, right? And so, they can share what they know. If let's say this is even a physician, verified physician, they can share what they know, but also distribute the risk that's associated with that. And so just as an example, you hear stories all across the board now where healthcare providers and frontline workers didn't have a voice to describe some of the lack of resources that were needed. And as a result, the way that the pandemic was handled, it could have been done much better. Let's just say that. You know, we did our best, but it could have been done much better. So shortages in PPE, protective equipment, right? Shortages in mechanical ventilators, right? The novel therapies and testing, right? Shortages in testing. And so what ended up happening was providers that actually spoke out were often reprimanded, or their voice had to get, let's say, put through several layers of PR and HR and legal and so on and so forth. And so as a result, the actual data itself didn't come out. So that ability to actually distribute the risk was very important. And the last part of that, apart from sovereign data and sovereign identity, is sovereign health. And, you know, for me, that's a vision where you can actually donate your own data to a cause that's near and dear to you, whether that be breast cancer research, COVID-19 aftermath, or even a platform where you could monetize your own data for a cause that you actually believe in, right? And by default, first and foremost, no fine print, no subclauses, it's your data. And so this decentralizes medical research, clinical trials, surveillance and efficacy of these medications, and ultimately can lead to a more personalized medicine rather. And so, you know, when I think about that, a very real example came to mind where a box of N95 masks showed up at my brother's doorstep as a donation in order to continue to fight the front lines. And that arrived from what we'll call an anonymous source. But what that was delivering the solution, or delivering what you can call, you know, preventative measures directly to the individual, and empowers the individual. And so what that describes to me is also what we saw in ASCO 19, which is a group of people coming together. And when you... essentially what that was, you know, in a time right now in all walks of life where people are struggling to pay rent, to get food on the table, find shelter and survival, and it's even difficult to think clearly and perform simple duties for a lot of people, including frontline providers, when you put them all together into this sort of web of social connectivity, what you find ends up happening is you see creativity, innovation, you see problem solving, and all that's amplified in a synergistic way, right, to save lives and to continue thinking through these difficult times. So, you know, in many ways, empowering decision making.
Yeah, and I guess to add to that, I mean, you know, you guys are from the medical profession. It is scientifically proven that the act of giving, you know, it reduces stress and anxiety. And so, you know, we're entering into probably what is going to be the greatest mental health issue, you know, or era that we've gone through as humanity, you know, with all of these challenges that people are facing right now. And I think it's incredibly important that people do, you know, work on projects like this. And it's, and you can see that, you know, I think about some of the wonderful people that we work with, or get to work with on an hourly and daily basis. And you look at someone like Shreya, you know, who puts in a ton of time with us. Alice, you know, who puts in a ton of time, plus the other 300, you know, people that are there, that are, you know, tirelessly working, and, you know, sponsors, right? We went and talked to, you know, you guys brought on Slack, Unbounce, Trello. Who else did we have in here? We had a bunch of great people. We had Figma, you know, Atomic Motion, and Sharif's company came in when I asked him to, you know, I said, buddy, I need some help. And he jumped in right away. And Global Skills Hub, of course, but, you know, two in particular that I, you know, I was able to kind of go out there and get is Unito.io. You know, we've been working with Evan over there, and he's just been incredible. You know, they want to help. And, you know, when you guys said that we needed this translation software called WeGlot, you know, I said, hey, let me go find out. And I messaged Augustine Prott on LinkedIn. And 2 minutes later, as the co-founder and CEO of that company, he responded and he said, no problem. Tell me what we need to do. And, you know, so you had the strength of these incredible people all around you, whether it was tech companies, whether it was marketing people, whether it was PR people and you know, and then Singularity.net jumped in and all these things. So you had all these great people around you. Tell me, what's the message that you want to tell all of them?
Yeah, first and foremost, thank you so much. I think it cannot be stressed enough that this would not have been possible with all the sponsors, without all the sponsors out there. The second thing is that the team members, the men and women that you've mentioned, I also want to put a shout out for Aviskar, who has been one of the most impressive developer over in Nepal for us. At Jay, who's kind of helped to put a lot of this stuff together and maintain a workflow in the CIDC process that was incredible. But yeah, none of this would have been possible without teams working together and resources. And just the idea, the validation of having your companies get involved really made the momentum possible. That's first and foremost. The second is the talent. I think one of the things that really inspired us to do the open source project was we had, Ray and I had worked together with a smaller group of coders before the open source community that truly believed in open source, right? That's kind of how we did it. You know, as physicians, we don't deal with open source as much, but as the developers that have been influencing us, that has certainly made a huge impact in the direction that we moved. But we saw these young developers that can move at the speed of light, right? Like they were able to put thousands of lines of code down literally within days and have an MVP over a weekend. And that changed everything, because if you could do that, then you can certainly fix a pandemic, right? You can certainly slow or stop a pandemic, because if you can develop technology that can reach people with web capabilities that are globally connected and with the power to do so moved by companies that are willing to help, giving us translational abilities to touch with countries that speak in different languages, to have storage capability, and to be able to develop beautiful websites, to be able to engage people. Information in and of itself is only 50% of it. Engagement is absolutely necessary. And so the marketing team, the talent, and the ability for them to move so quickly really, really made this possible. And everybody used their talents to be able to do this. And the unification, as you said, Yusuf, was incredible, because what I found is that while people were under the stress of the economics a burden, as well as, you know, having to stay home and be away from their workplaces, that's a burden in of itself. Then you have the crushing overtone of a pandemic, of a killer virus, right? That's a second stress that nobody's seen before. So you're absolutely right. The mental stress that is occurring on people. And for physicians, right, I can tell you on the front line of physicians, I was there. I mean, how close it was for us to be on the brink of just losing it, right, on the front lines, right? And so this project, and I highly advocate of getting people involved in the project and other projects, not just ours, but it really helped people put their skills or basically take the energy levels or even just take their mind off of the whole stress of things and do something incredibly productive. And that feedback, that positive cycle of being productive and doing something for the world and unifying, really calm the stress and thereby increasing their productivity. We just saw that over and over again. And we were just absolutely inspired by, you know, what came out of this. So this is really one of the biggest lessons is that very early on, when you see something like this coming, definitely get involved with the community. You know, yes, stay home, shelter, but first and foremost is reach out. There's going to be tons of people doing things that are trying to help. You know, we are certainly just one of them. We were hoping to be one of the bigger impact players. We were certainly some of the front runners that are doing this first. But by getting involved, you really help yourselves and really help the community out.
So, you know, I want to I think that's incredibly important. You know, I I got involved because my sister is a doctor. And no matter as hard as it was for everyone else going through this, frontline physicians had it the worst. You know, like I'm in tech, you know, and I saw a bunch of whiny babies in tech worry about, you know, wage subsidies and stuff like that. What was really happening was people's lives were at stake. This was never a question of what needed to happen. And, you know, as people reflected and did what they call the great pause, you know, many of us made decisions that there was a now and there was a next coming. And so we could prepare for the next and the new economy and all that stuff. But what was important to do was save lives. And what was important to do as industries around the world was to back the people that were actually doing that. And so it was, you know, and I going back to the comment that you made earlier about innovation in Silicon Valley and places like Toronto and stuff like that, you know, I believe that there's better innovation when it's done for the reason of impact, which is exactly what you did. It's for the reason of actually doing something, you know, going out there. And, you know, and you guys touched on something so beautiful is that by all these people being able to do this, they got, you know, there was no bosses in here. This was my first time being involved in an open source project. You know, I sat down with Jonathan Oop, who was another great, you know, mentor of ours here right in the beginning of this project for me to understand what open source was. But what open source does is it allows people to play at their absolute best. It allows people to do what they're, you know, greatest at and most passionate at. And I think we saw that as we saw that in all the great people that are involved.
I completely agree.
What do you think about that?
And, you know, to tackle two questions there, the first earlier that you mentioned is that, you know, who was the audience for this? But also, what is the message now going forward? If there was one pivot, you know, what started as frontline physicians to other frontline physicians and all healthcare providers, what I would say now is that, you know, the public awareness sort of as we move forward to what might be considered the new normal or the new abnormal, you know, it's going to require a change in the way that we think about healthcare, the way that we think about how we rebuild our communities, right, in these cities from the ground up. And what we've witnessed, as you mentioned, from these open source communities is that when everyone's playing at their best and really focusing and doubling down on what their skills are, things get done. And so as we begin to think about that process of reopening, it's not going to be one size fits all. It's going to be based on locality, population density, transmission rates, you know, the antibody status of populations, hospital capacity, diagnosing, testing availability. And so as all that happens, what's going to be important is where this actually started, which was a grassroots project. It grew organically and then exponentially above and beyond what we had thought it would be. You know, it grew much bigger than any one of us individually. And so the one thing I would leave with folks is that, like, you know, this is going to leave a mark on society, in my opinion, and there were costs incurred, you know, whether that's people filing for unemployment for the first time, or they had a family member that had an ICU admission or a loved one. So as these sort of sacrifices were made, you know, I do have this significant fear that, and it's quite visceral and palpable that, you know, with all the physical and economic suffering that we endured, you know, our species is remarkable. It has a remarkable amnesia at forgetting things. You know, the anthrax of 2001, the bird flu scare of 2005, H1N1 of 2009, you know, Ebola of 2013-14. Yeah, and then Zika shortly after that.
The World War.
It would be an unmitigated disaster. Right? 2 years from now, you know, we let all of these lessons of innovation and courage, the interconnectedness globally, the selflessness, if we let all that dissipate into just a blip on the radar, that would be a shame. So I would want to ask questions.
Well, I think to cover it from that perspective, though, I think it's so important that where you're just to touch on this, to pause for a second, is that the selflessness, you know, and I'm starting to see more of it as people are starting to realize that they need to do that. You know, I've seen some great people and companies out there, not-for-profits run around and really just try to help. And, you know, we've seen it in the 3D printing world. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine named Doug Jones out in Nova Scotia. And, you know, he got the 3D or printing community together just to print out these things that you put on the back of your mask and they protect your ears a bit better, because I guess the masks, and you guys are doctors, you probably know, like, I guess the masks really, really bother you after about 8 or 9 years hours of wearing them.
Oh, it's painful. I mean, every day I'm constantly rubbing my ears to stop it from hurting. I need some of those.
Yeah, Doug, if you're listening to this, buddy, from Ignite out in Nova Scotia, send over some of those to Dr. Roger, please.
Yes, please.
You know, just to kind of close off here in the United States, so, you know, one thing, my son, I told him to be quiet, so he's not going to ask this question, but, you know, part of the reason I do this podcast is to share with my kids. I want them to be able to look back and see the evolvement of their father and see how,
you know, I want this lesson of so that they don't go through amnesia, exactly like you talked about. And they see how we as parents stood during this time. You know, we didn't get stressed out and back down. We said, hey, there's a fight coming our way. It happens to include all of us, right? And so for the first time, you know, for all of us who thought we were different, it turns out we're exactly the same. We can be affected exactly the same. And if we get together and do something, we do that. So I want you to explain to my sons here, you know, because this was their question, is what did Daddy play at his best doing? What was Yusuf's involvement, or what was Global Skills Hub's involvement in ASCO 19?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely a vital, an amazing individual and a leader as you know, it's true to the title of the name of your company. I mean, you were able to obtain global people with amazing talent, and that is your talent, Yusuf. You're able to, I've only seen one other individual in my entire lifetime that can do what you do, and I didn't think I was ever going to meet another individual do that again. And I recognized it very early on, is that you are someone that creates connection easily, just by nature. And that is your secret super ability. And you can bring them to the table and you can unify their cause and you can make stuff happen. And in this particular case,
put a word
we're
on
working
that,
on
I would
saving
say
the
fusion,
world.
Right? You're fusing individuals together. Yeah.
Wow. I appreciate that. I'm going to make sure my wife listens to that too. She knows what the hell I was doing for 18 hours a day. You know, I think, as you guys know, like we had some nights where I was up to like 4 or 5 in the morning here in Bucharest. You guys are like, do you ever sleep? And, you know, my wife has been incredibly supportive over the past few weeks because she was like, look, no, she goes, I understand. She goes, I understand it's about Aisha.
Yeah.
And because it's about Aisha, it's also about the rest of the world. And the way we, you know, look at the world is that, hey, if we protect our family and then protect our neighbor, if everyone else just does that, you know, we can amplify care and kindness throughout the world. You know, I love that hashtag that's been floating around. Kindness is contagious. And, you know, there's one other, you know, person or you know, company that I just wanted to give a quick shout out to, because we tend to forget them as sponsors or partners. But, you know, Sharpest Minds. You know, I called up, I remember you and I were having a conversation and you were like, we need more ML, we need more data science, we need more AI. And so I go out there and I said, don't worry about it, I'm going to get back to you. And I go and I talk to Edward Harris, and same thing. I message him, I'm like, buddy, Ed, I got this challenge. We're working on this thing. These doctors are amazing. This entire group of people is amazing. Can you help us out? And he's like, yeah, no problem. Jumps on it right away. And, you know, he created a lot and he posted a lot on LinkedIn about, you know, getting more AI and data scientists out there. And, you know, I remember getting a message from a data scientist from the World Bank, and they were like, can I help with this project? And I've seen something, you know, here. So, you know, I think that was, you know, it's incredibly important to recognize all those incredible people. We would be able to, we would sit here all day if we wanted to say thank you to people like Sharpe and you know,
Shubo, oh yeah, AK Brian
Steph
Shubo,
Shubnum, you know,
yeah, actually, I gotta say, Anna Stephanie, yeah. Anna Kate was impressive. She came from a company that developed and designed art as an applicable technology to the world, right? And she turned out to have created a tremendous amount of our branding and our engagement web part, the landing page. But she came from a company that logo is to think outside the box.
Oh, I love it.
If you're working
I have to give a shout out to Orbital Tech, who's their full-time dev to our back end, to really make things functional and seamless as the open source project grows. And by the way, you know, I do have to say, you know, a lot of changes are going to happen. Changes are happening in our communities, but also to the product, product being an open source set of code. And really what that is and what you're looking at is folks just figuring it out. I mean, even you, Yusuf, you know, what your super skill is, figuring things out and problem solving. So, you know, there's one thing that's very important for me to say is we need to ask the right questions. And what is it going to be like when the doors start to open up again. Right. And I think for your children, right, what do we want it to look like, right? So we have, on the one hand, this amazing reset that is horrific in so many ways, but also an opportunity in others. And so I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but we have a vision for the future. And I think it's our imperative to move towards it. And that's my, you know, call to everyone else, is what your visions are and make it so.
Yeah, that was one of the major things that that drove me to the front lines, actually. I mean, when on the coming days that we knew this was coming, and then the PPE was necessary and so forth like that, I really thought about who were we building this new world for, right? If we didn't do this, right? If we didn't stand by the patients that were coming in, or, you know, the parents that were dying on these ventilators, our children will not have a future, right? They will lose. Right. They will lose all the people that they love that will bring them into the new century. And so, you know, one of the major driving forces that I felt absolutely I needed to be there was really for these children that and your children.
And you're a father as well, right, Roger?
I looked at my kids, and that was the first thing I said. I said, Kingston and Kingsley, you know, if we didn't do this, you would not have the teachers, and you would not have the, you know, the people that are working around you. You will not have the great facilities and infrastructures that you get to work with that we've all had, right?
Go ahead.
You know, right. It's
no, I'm not. You know,
and Ray, are you? This is important. Ray, are you? You're a father as well. Well, what are you doing, man? Listen to you. Look at you.
So I've been spending a lot of coding. You got to follow him on that step as well. Video time with Queensland, my niece, which is Roger's daughter. And, you know, when you look at the technology, and this is something to really double right. down on, and that ability as part of the, you know, this new world of working remote, utilizing technology in new and innovative ways. I spend a lot of time with my niece, you know, almost daily to try to get a little bit of FaceTime with her. And so, you know, one of the folks that I'd be remiss not to thank are also a lot of the local health departments, local communities that are trying to work their way through continuing to provide remote education, remote health advice, remote, you know, testing advice. And so what should have, and, you know, there's no judgment here. Things move very fast, but typically on a national scale, folks that help set the tone of the seriousness of this really was delegated or relegated to our local communities, local health departments. And so even, you know, in our community here, a COVID-19 assessment site was set up thanks fully to family physicians in the local area, rallying together, going to town hall meetings, expressing a need, and of course, parents, right? I mean, these family physicians were also parents, and just saying, we need these sites set up because all of the clinics closed down at appropriate times. And so when folks have nowhere to go, like you said, you know, if you have a family member that's a doctor, maybe you call them and they can speak that foreign language to you, that medical language. But if you don't have that, who do you call? And I think that that's providing that social support structure throughout small communities is very important for our children and family members.
Definitely. Okay, so, you know, I know the three of us could go on talking for hours. There's so much more that we want to talk about. So I'd love to get you guys back on as things kind of after we get this thing launched out and the product evolves and then it's open source. But, you know, at the end of every podcast, what we like to do is I ask some questions, and, you know, I kind of get, these are kind of the anchors of the podcast per se. But, you know, first and foremost, I want to say a couple things before we get into those questions. And, you know, I really, really want to take this opportunity to thank you guys. Not only from a perspective of what you've done and laying out that vision, and, you know, and when you lay out a vision, it magnetized the good people around the world. And this is just the beginning. I mean, after this thing, I mean, we're going to see a whole bunch more great people come together to work on this. So I really want to thank you guys. I want to thank you as physicians, as healthcare workers as well, and your families and your wife and you know, who's also a doctor. And I think that's important. You know, when I, you know, I was thinking about, as you're talking about your niece and your daughter, and you know, it's interesting because when things open back up, I can't wait to actually meet you guys in person.
Us too, Yusuf.
You know, we've never met, and you know, and I wonder that, you know, like one day if I meet your daughter and your niece and they ask me about you, I'm reminded of the quote from 10,000 BC. I really didn't like the movie, but I love this quote. And it's not the most diverse and inclusive way that it's put out, but I'm going to read it to you anyways, because I want you to know this is what I would say to them. I would say that a good man draws a circle around himself and cares for those within his womb, within. And usually that's his wife and his kids. Other men draw a larger circle and bring within them their brothers and their sisters. But some men have a great destiny. They must draw around themselves a circle that includes many, many, many more. Your father was one of those men, and you must decide for yourself whether you are as well. So I just wanted to thank you once again for all that you've done. At the end of the podcast, we ask 3 to 5 rapid questions. So I'm going to give you guys cannot think. It's like quick one sentence answers here. And as emotional as that made a bit for you, we're going to have some fun. So I'm going to ask you guys both the same question first, and then I'm going to ask you guys questions individually. Okay. So the first question I have for you, and this one's for Roger, what is the one thing that you believe every kid like Arman, Yusuf, Samir, and your kids, what's the one thing that you want them to know about life?
That's important to explore. I think I'm an explorer, and it's so important for them to keep their minds open and explore. And that's when the solutions to some of the hardest problems and the most difficult challenges will be open to you. It's when you're not looking, that's when the solutions will have no chance.
Amazing. Ray, what is the one video game that you can beat your brother at any day?
I would have to say, although we've not duoed at this, I think, for quite a long time, maybe Super Mario Kart. Yeah, Super Mario Kart. Yeah.
Super Mario Kart. Roger, you're quarantined. You're isolated for 14 days. What is the one food you must keep with you?
Oh, no. It's got to be instant noodles.
Spoken like a true That's person great. Who was a student at one point in life.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, Ray, in terms of your grandparents, you know, you guys touched on them earlier, and I'm not sure if they're still with us or not. Are they still with us? No. So God rest their souls. If they could see, I mean, they do see you, and they're probably incredibly proud at the legacy they left behind. But you know, what would be one message?
You know,
you
thanks for
them?
Teaching us. You know, I think that they've been really ingrained into both of us, myself in particular, that I feel is a sense of imparting or departing knowledge, and to never stop learning. Growth is something that I strive very deeply for, and that seeking of knowledge. So thanks for teaching us, Grandma, Grandpa, and we will try to do the same to the children that follow.
Well, you guys are amazing. You know, I wanted to get you some funny questions, but we're going to have to leave that for another time. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. ASCO19.com. You know, we're requesting all the physicians out there to get on as soon as possible, start answering the questions. And we're requesting everyone in the public to start asking more and more questions. So as we go and do this, the part that we need now from everybody is that we need everyone to get on there and just start asking and answering questions. And if we can get that going, we will answer the question that we sat about and talked about that day, which was, can we spread information faster than the virus? Thank you so much for your
Thank
time.
Thank you very
guys.
Much, Yusuf. Really appreciate
day.
It.
I'll
yeah,
see
we'll see you
on Slack
there
in a few minutes.
Thank you, Bye. Yusuf. Thank you. We'll see you there.